The following presentation was originally produced in video format by our friends at the Victoria Conference in Australia and can be seen on our website below the audio version. The audio format is made available with permission of the Victoria Conference in Australia. Special thanks to Miroslav Stekla, AV specialist, for his original composition and performance of intros and outros for Clifford Goldstein's series at Big Camp 25.
The Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky, born in 1821 and he died in 1881. His father was a doctor who it is believed had been murdered by his own serfs. And when he was a young man, Dostoevsky got involved in radical politics, an underground political movement, and he had gotten arrested by Tsar Nicholas I, and he was sentenced to death, and they put a bunch of them up in front of a firing squad, and it was ready, aim, and they had never intended to shoot these kids. They just wanted to scare them, and I assume that scared them. And they sent him off. He went off to Siberia for 4 or 5 years. And one of his early books was called The House of the Dead. And it was about his time in the prison camp. And Fyodor Dostoevsky, many consider him the greatest novelist of the 19th century. I'm tired. But he wrote books about God and faith and morals and just struggled with many questions about morality. He was the one I was often credit to. If there is no God, everything is permissible. And probably his most famous novel was called The Brothers Karamazov. It had all sorts of themes in there. And there was this most famous, he has this famous chapter called The Grand Inquisitor. So in some ways they say the Brothers Karamazov was the greatest novel of the 19th century, and this was the greatest chapter in the greatest novel written by the greatest novelist. And it is good. It is good if you've never read it. But there's this famous scene where Ivan Karamazov, who's symbolizing, if not atheism, then really skepticism about the whole idea of a goodness of God, and he's arguing with his brother, Alyosha, a monk. And then Ivan starts just telling these horrible stories about atrocities that happened to children. And I read a biography of Dostoevsky, and according to the biography, these stories were not made up. These were actual news events, things that happened that Dostoevsky wrote about, but he just wrote about one horrible atrocity after another happening to children, And I guess his question was, how could these incidents and others like them could ever be justified at the end of the age when some divine harmony is to be restored, when all insufferable questions are to be resolved, and when all God's ways are forever vindicated before men and angels. And Ivan thunders, I want to see with my own eyes the hind lie down with the lion and the victim rise up and embrace his murderer. I want to be there when everyone suddenly understands what it has all been for. But then there are the children, and what am I to do about them? That's a question I can't answer. For the 100th time, I repeat, there are a number of questions, but I've taken only the children. Because in their case, what I mean is so unanswerably clear. Listen, if all must suffer to pay for the eternal harmony, what have the children to do with it? Tell me, please. You know, there really are many very good logical, solid logical reasons for the existence of God. I mean, in the end, nothing came from itself. Nothing created itself. Anything created had to be created by something before it. And you go back and back and back, and sooner or later, you need something uncreated, something that was always there to explain everything that once didn't exist and then did come into existence. And for many, it's obviously that's God. And then there's the teleological argument. I don't care. The more I live, the more complicated, the more I see of the natural world. It's the most obvious thing. In fact, I'm just working on an article right now called The Hydrogen Atom. I just finished it off before I came here. The hydrogen atom is the simplest atom. It's a nucleus and an electron. And then it's number one on the periodic table of elements. It's a nucleus which has one proton and an electron cloud. And I'm not going to get into it, but you have no idea how complicated the forces that are there that are holding this thing together. In the article, I got a physicist friend of mine to help me pick out three or four of the many complicated mathematical formulas just to describe a hydrogen atom. I mean, everywhere around you see powerful, logical. If you want to believe this all happened by chance, go ahead. But the overwhelming logical evidence is for a creator God. And then you could take what some call the moral argument for God. Let's say in the Second World War, let's say the Nazis won the war. Let's say they won, and under the brilliant propaganda of Joseph Goebbels, he convinced the world that anybody who had one Jewish grandparent, if you had one Jewish grandparent, you deserved to die. And suppose he convinced everybody, everybody, that was the right thing to do. Would it be the right thing to do? And if you've got some problems with that, some say that points to some kind of transcendent morality. And where would that come from if it wasn't for some transcendence above us? Because if it all came from humans and humans alone said it was fine, then it would have to be fine. And if you got a problem with that, that's evidence for the existence of God. And there are other arguments as well. Now, none of these arguments in and of itself proves the existence of God. And even if you put them all together, in my thinking there, any one of them is powerful. You put them all together, there's very powerful, logical, rational reasons. The longer I live, I think atheism is the most irrational of all human isms that you could find out there. But what these arguments don't do, they're as good as far as they go. And I guess it's not far enough because, again, everybody would believe. But what they do is they show there's logical, reasonable evidence for belief in God. Yet however logical and reasonable the evidence, however strong a logical, rational, intelligent edifice they make for faith, either alone or you weave them all together, what they don't do, either separately or bunched together, is come close to answering Ivan Karamazov's question, the children, what am I to do about then? However logical and reasonable, these proofs are no more logical and reasonable than the very logical and reasonable question, which is, if God is all-loving, all-powerful, all-knowing, why is there so much suffering in the world? Why is there so much pain in the world? Why is there a world where children, innocent children, face some horrendous atrocities. That, I think, is a very logical, reasonable question to ask. If God is perfectly loving, Scottish philosopher John Hick wrote, he said, if God is perfectly loving, he must wish to abolish evil. And if he is all powerful, he must be able to abolish evil. But evil exists. Therefore, God cannot be both omnipotent and perfectly loving. That is, however, unless you understand, when we talk about God's omnipotence, it doesn't mean that God can do the logically impossible. Can God create a triangle that has four sides? See what I'm saying? If it's a triangle, it has three sides. You can't create a triangle that has four sides. Can omnipotence create a perfect circle composed of four right angle edges? Can't. It's logically impossible. Okay, can God make 2 + 2 = 5? No, because the moment it's 5, it's no longer 2 + 2. And where I'm going with this is, can God create a love that is forced? This is a crucial point, because the moment it's forced, it's no longer love. Just as a triangle to be a triangle has to have three sides, love to be love must be freely given, or it's not love at all. To force love is to violate it, it's to destroy it. Love by its very nature has to be freely given, otherwise it's not love. Even God, the creator of the cosmos, cannot create a love that is forced. Again, the moment it's forced, it's something else. God could create obedience without freedom. He could create law without freedom. He could create order without freedom. And God can force every creature in the universe to love him. I mean, he could force every creature in the universe to worship him. He could force every creature in the universe to obey him, to fear him, but he can't force a single creature to love him. So truly, the only way God could have beings who could experience love and give love is to create them as morally free beings. You know, it's funny, I've noticed here, you Australians, you like your dogs, don't you? A lot of people here have dogs. Well, you know, I never grew up with a dog. I never liked them. And then my wife one day came home with a pug. And, you know, I didn't know anything. All I ever had was a cat. Okay, and I just thought a dog was just a big cat or something. Well, one day I'm walking down the stairs with this pug pup, and I got something in my hand, and I just dropped the dog. I just dropped the dog, because, you know, a cat would have landed on its feet and brushed off and walked away, and the poor dog went flying down the stairs. And my wife goes, throwing my dog down the stairs? You know, I was horrified, because I didn't know. But the point is, yeah, you love the, I was amazed by the level of love that the dog could give you. A cat, they don't care. You know, you feed them, you know, they'll come around and purr, but anyway, the point is, I've learned to love my dogs, but, you know, dogs could be a pain in the neck. After the pug, when poor Fergie died, you know, I would travel and have little kids at home, and I got this great big German Shepherd, Penny. This dog was scared of her own shadow. I mean, this dog would see a stink bug, and she'd jump on the bed in the middle of the night, shaking, 100-pound shaking over a stink bug. But she was a fearsome-looking beast. And I remember one day my wife and I pull up into the driveway, and there's that Shepherd staring out the window, ears up. I mean, she almost scared us. Okay. But anyway, the point is, dogs could be a hassle. Now, suppose you could have a dog. And Penny did have a bad habit of biting people. You know, that was a problem too. 100-pound dog biting people doesn't go over well. But suppose you could have a dog and you never had to worry about the dog biting anyone. And you never had the dog worry about the dog barking when you didn't want it to. Or the dog getting fleas or rabies or whatever. Would you like a dog like that? Well, you know, you can have one. You can have one. Sony makes a robot dog. Okay? Makes a dog you can just plug it in and you train whatever and it does. Now, let me ask you a question. And you'll see where I'm going. Would you trade your dog, even with all the hassles? Because I got a Corgi Yorkie mix now. Got his cutest little thing. Not very obedient, but the hassle galore. Just, you'll call her and she'll just stare at you and look at you and totally ignore you. But anyway, I would not trade that dog for a robot. Can you see what I'm saying? And in a parallel, God could have made us as robots. He could have made us so we could disobey and so on and so forth. But to create us as beings who could love, he had to create us free. We had to have the freedom not to love. And that entails a risk, a real risk. The freedom is not an illusion. The freedom that God has given us is real. Okay, so let's say you accept this. For God to create beings who could love him, he had no choice. Even God cannot force love. He had to create us free, truly free, and that entailed the risk we know. Okay, so the next question is, if God is all-knowing, why did he create us as free moral beings if he knew not only that we had the potential for evil, that we would eventually do evil? God knew beforehand all this would happen, and he created us anyway. I mean, I know of no logical contradiction that our non-existence would entail. You see what I'm saying? I mean, the universe did fine for a long time without us, okay? It wasn't like God had to create us. But he knew he created us anyway. He created us free, and he knew what was going to happen, and he did it anyway because he was all-knowing, okay? So first, God creates us despite his foreknowledge. Now let's look where we've been. God had to make us free if we are to love. He didn't have to create us, but he created us anyway, and because he's all-knowing, he knew that we would fall. But you know, if God is also all-loving, that God, in the end, he's going to make it all right. He's going to fix it all. In the end, he's going to make it all okay. Okay, now if you follow me along here, if you follow this again, but this all leads to even a greater question. Okay, again, one last time. Had to create us free. All knowing, he knew what would happen. He did it anyway. All loving. Ultimately, he's going to bring a greater good. He's going to bring good out of all that happened. But this leads to one final question. A question that really bugs me. If God is going to make it all okay in the end, and if all God's ways are to be exonerated in the grand and final harmony that vindicates God in heaven and all that, vindicates everything that has happened on earth, How can God justify working it all out here in the dirt, in human blood, sweat, and tears, while God sits enthroned in the glory of heaven and the angels are bowing down and worshiping him and doing his bidding? Whatever the profound questions, whatever the grand moral issues to be resolved in the great controversy between good and evil, however efficiently and permanently God is going to answer all these questions and erase all these doubts, the question still remains. Why should an omnipotent, omniscient God be safely ensconced somewhere up in the sky, knowing the end from the beginning, while he watches us poor fools crawl on our helpless bellies here, ignorant of the next moment, much less the conclusion of all things? Why couldn't whatever point God wanted to make be made by him rather than with human beings us so miserably and inextricably drawn into this through no choice of our own? Okay, does this make sense? Can you see where I'm going? God had no choice. He creates us free. He was all-knowing. He knew what was going to happen. He did it anyway, and yet he's all-loving. He's going to make it all right in the end. But, oh, that's great. He's going to make it all right in the end through everything that happens down here while he's up in heaven. I think that's a valid question. I know of only one answer. And to take that answer, we need to go back to another 19th century writer, a German, a person whose life somewhat overlapped with Dostoevsky's, though he was born 20 years later. And his name, you probably have heard the name Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche was a hardcore atheist. In fact, Nietzsche was born, I think, either a week before or after the Great Disappointment. And he hated Christianity, and he, if you read the stuff, the man was a genius and a lunatic. And at some point, you know, he ended up going into dying insane. I mean, he really lost his mind at the end. And sometimes it's hard to know whether you're reading the madman or the genius. But he really has been very, very influential. And you know, every time there's a school shooting in America, you know, they blame it all on Nietzsche and so on and so forth. And they say he was Hitler's prophet and all that. Nietzsche would have hated Hitler. But he's very influential. And the irony is, there was a quote from Nietzsche that really, more than anything else, helped me grapple with this question of evil. Again, coming from Nietzsche. Now, I'm going to read it to you. It's from his book, Thus Spake Zarathustra. And when I read the quote to you, you're going to go, huh? You're going to scratch your head, but I want to flesh it out a little bit. Here is this quote in Thus Spake Zarathustra that opened up a whole new understanding for me in this admittedly, logically difficult question of all the evil and suffering in a world created by an all-knowing, all-loving, all-good, all-powerful God. Here's the quote. In the final analysis, one experiences only one's self. Close quote. Huh? In the end, in the final analysis, one experiences only one's self. Now think about this. When we grieve with the grieving, when we weep with the weeping, when we suffer with those who are suffering, we experience only our own grief, only our own cries, only our own anguish, never another's. just as we bleed our own blood, we spew our own spit, we secrete our own sweat, never another's, even no matter how fused our flesh is. We know other people's pain only and always through our own, filtered only through our own. In other words, whether a mother holding a feverish infant to her breast or a husband holding in his arms a crumpled, dying wife, you can't splice into anybody's body. You can't splice into somebody's nerves and feel the slightest pinprick of what they feel. You can feel anguish and pain and sorrow, but it's only the anguish and pain and sorrow of your own nerves, only the amount that your own nerves and your own chemicals in your own body allow you to, no matter how loud, outrageous, or consuming. Pain is more private than thought. You can share your thoughts, but you can't share your pain. You see what I'm saying? There's only a certain number of miles of nerves in a human body. There's only a finite amount of suffering that every human being has. And all they've ever known, and all you will ever know, even when you're sorrow for somebody else, you're still feeling your own pain, your own sorrow. The numbers freak us out. The numbers, oh my goodness, one after another, million here, 20 million here, 100,000 here, all these again, and all these massive numbers. But again, every single person suffered only as an individual. They knew only the only amount of pain that their own body can allow them to have, not a speck more. In fact, here, look what the Bible says here. Job 14:22, he says, he feels but the pain of his own body. Okay, and 2 Chronicles 6:29. Whatever prayer, whatever supplication is made by anyone, by all your people, Israel, when each one knows his own pain and his own grief, each one knows his own burden and his own grief. And interesting, the Hebrew word there for his own grief is makovo. The root word is makav, and the third person masculine singular possessive pronoun, makovo. Each one knows his own. This privatization of pain, it's good. It's good. I mean, it's hard enough dealing with our own pain. Dealing with our own pain, but can you imagine if you could feel somebody else's pain as well and their sorrow as well? You might sorrow with them, but again, it's only your own pain, only your own sorrows, never more. Each one knows makovo, his own pain and his own suffering. You know, they sometimes talk about the sum total of human suffering. But it's never summed up and totaled. Does that make sense? It's never. You're going to know only yours. You're going to know only yours. And no matter how much you've empathized with others, it's still limited only by what your own body and mind could take. There is, however, one exception, okay, to this, and that's at the cross. At the cross, the creator of the universe, the one upon whom all that was created rests, he shrank down into human flesh, and his life was crushed out by all the pain, all the sorrow, all the anguish of the world. Though we experience only our own fear, only our own loathing, at the cross, Jesus experienced everyone's else. If you read Isaiah 53:4, Isaiah 53:4 says this. It says, he bore our griefs and carried our sorrows. That's actually a lousy translation. But he said, he bore our griefs and our sorrows. Whose? We are not Calvinists. We do not believe in what they teach as limited atonement. It's just horrible teaching. I'm sorry. It's just, the more I learn about Reformed theology, the more it's just ghastly. And which is that Jesus died for a certain select few, and that all the others, no matter how they live, God predestined them to be lost. So no matter how they live, they were lost. Jesus didn't die for them. And then God's going to burn them in hell for all eternity. Okay, that's John Calvin theology. That's Reformed theology. Okay, but it says here, he bore our griefs and our sorrows. Ours? Whose? We believe Jesus died for the whole world. And it's fascinating. The Hebrew word for bore, he bore our griefs, the Hebrew word for griefs is the same word that we read in 2 Chronicles 26. Each man knows his own, or makovo, his own. And Isaiah 53 says he bore makovenu. He bore our griefs, our makov. I don't want to read more into the text than is there. But I don't want to read less either. The Bible says, talking about Jesus, Isaiah 53, he bore our makav. Each man knows his own, but he bore ours. All the sicknesses, all the suffering, all the sorrows of the entire world fell on him. That's what the text says. I said, I don't want to read more into it, but I don't want to read less. Let me read you what Ellen White said. She doesn't say this exact same thing, but it's close. She says, man has not been made a sin bearer, and he will never know the horror of the curse of sin which the Savior bore. No sorrow can bear any comparison with the sorrow of him upon whom the wrath of God fell with overwhelming force. Human nature can endure but a limited amount of test and trial. The finite can endure only the finite measure, and human nature succumbs. But the nature of Christ had a greater capacity for suffering, for the human existed in the divine nature and created a capacity for something to endure, which resulted from the sins of a lost world. That's 5 BC 1103. However much blood shed and tears have been shed and spilled, again, no one has suffered more than a single human can suffer. Our pain has never surpassed our finitude. No one ever ached more than he or she individually could withstand. I suppose a certain threshold is crossed and you're gone. In contrast, again, I don't understand at all. I'm just reading you. The text said he bore our grief and our sorrows. And the other word is actually the other word in there, but sorrows is a word for sickness. That's the Hebrew word that's often used with sickness. Saying, he bore out something corporately happened to God in Christ on the cross, something that we could never experience, that he alone as God had experienced. So in contrast, far from God remaining safely ensconced somewhere up in the sky, at the cross, the evils of the world and all their doleful results fell on him, an infinite God, in a way that none of us could ever know. So where have we been? Let's just follow away on my line of thinking here. I don't know if it works for you, but it's been very helpful to me. again, repeat myself. As I get older, my wife says, you've got to stop this. As I get older, I repeat myself more. I said, honey, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's getting worse and worse. She complains about me talking. It's so funny because I just have this bad habit of talking to myself. And not long after we were married, I'm sitting there talking to myself, and my wife is looking at me. What are you doing? I said, I'm talking to myself in Swedish. And she goes, we were only married a month. She goes, I married a guy who talks to himself in Swedish? And it gets worse. And then my kids, I remember I was in the car one day, and my daughter, about 7, you're doing it again, Dad. You're doing it again. She freaked out about me doing it. And now my granddaughter, goes, Pop, Pop talks to himself all the time. And it's getting worse. But anyways, but repetition too. But anyway, on another note, I got to stop deviating. All right, God had no choice. If he wanted us to love him, he had to create us free, okay? But he didn't have to create us. But he did it anyway because he's all-knowing. He knew all this would come. He knew every bit of suffering that would come, and yet he did it anyway. But because he's all-loving, he's going to make it okay in the end. But this then leads to the question that I brought. How fair is it that he's up in heaven being praised by the angels and so on, why it's all worked out here, why we suffer and go through everything that we go through until it is resolved? And again, the only answer I have, the best answer I could give to the question of evil, is at the cross, God suffered more than any of us could ever suffer. I'm just going to read you. Again, Isaiah, he bore our griefs, our makav, our suffering. He suffered infinitely more from sin than any of us ever could. Now, but this leads to another question. And something, because this doesn't fully answer everything. I know, and that's going to get to my point here. I remember I read an article one time. Oof, I don't remember how I came across it. Something Michigan Quarterly Review or something. I don't know how in the world I'd find this stuff. And it was about a woman who taught English to children in a hospital who were dying of cancer. And, you know, every line in the article was a zinger. I mean, every line just ripped your guts out as you're reading it. And she goes, the children I write with die. No matter how much I love them, no matter how creative they are, no matter how many poems they are written, or how much they want to live. As I said, every line, it just ripped at you. And then at one point, she said something in there that, again, too, kind of helped me with this. She was somewhere else, and she was talking to some doctor, and she said, I, like everybody else, was trying to make sense of what is nonsensical. Nonsensical. That is, it doesn't make sense. It can't be rationally explained. There's no good reason for it. And is it that better, that evil, like, and children dying of cancer is evil, that it be nonsensical and not logical, rational, explicable? Otherwise, what? Can you imagine if someone gets to heaven? Oh, Jesus, now I know why my family, my wife and 3 kids were burned alive in the house fire when the Christmas tree caught on fire, and they were all killed. Oh, yes, now that I see, it all makes perfect sense. Or, oh, Jesus, now I'm in heaven. Now I see, yes. Now I know why my 6-year-old got cancer, spent 3 years in the hospital, had limbs removed, all the pain and suffering, and died. Anyway, now I see it. It all makes perfect sense. Come on, that's sick. If there were good reasons for this, I don't want to know them. You don't want good reasons for this. However bad these tragedies, it would be worse if there was a good reason for them. But there's not. It's nonsense. Listen to here. Here's another Ellen White quote. It's impossible to so explain the origin of sin, but shift the word sin to evil. Okay? It's impossible to explain the origin of evil as to give a reason for its existence. Sin, evil, is an intruder for whose presence no reason can be given. It is mysterious, unaccountable. To excuse it is to defend it. Could excuse for it to be found or cause to be shown for its existence, it would cease to be sin. I don't want a good reason for all this evil and stuff, because if you got a good reason for it, in a certain way, you can justify it. Oh, it makes sense. I don't want all the evil in the world to be justified. See, so, I mean, how many of us have been through these experiences where something happens and you think, I don't understand this. I don't understand it. It makes no sense. Why did this happen? You're not supposed to understand it. It's inexplicable. You don't want a good reason for it. That in some cases, God, some good might come out of it. That's a totally separate thing. Oh, yes, I'm glad my daughter died. My daughter died, and that brought me back to the Lord, that kind of thing. I don't think that's going to fly. That's not going to fly. That kind of stuff doesn't work. It does. There's a good reason we don't understand it. If we could understand it, if it made sense, if it fit into some logical and rational plan, then it wouldn't be that evil. It wouldn't be that tragic because it serves some higher purpose. And I'm sorry, a six-year-old dying of cancer doesn't serve any higher purpose whatsoever. And you'll go out of your mind. You'll go crazy trying to find a higher purpose. And again, what about the text, all things work together for good? Well, again, what about all things working together for good doesn't mean all things are good. God can bring good out of things, but it doesn't make these things good. In the end, in the light of the cross. See, you know what? We as Adventists, how many of you here know the word theodicy? You know the word theodicy? It's a term I think any of us as Seventh-day Adventists ought to know. It's a fancy theological term, theodike. It's like the justification of God. Not justification like justification by faith. It's really the question that we're looking at. If God is all-knowing, all-loving, all-powerful, why is there so much evil? And a theodicy is an attempt to answer that the best it could be answered. But remember, a theodicy is ultimately, it's the justification of God, not the justification of evil. That's an important, it's not justifying evil, it's justifying God, and we have to. See, I no longer try, again, when evil and tragedy, I mean, it's like, I've got one friend right now, look, we all have our stories. We all have our things, and it just rips your guts out. But it's just, I no longer, Lord, what good does this do? What positive thing is coming out of this? Why, what purpose does it serve? I don't worry about that anymore. I don't look for it because I don't want, in so many of the cases, I don't want there to be one. What possibly could be a value, make some of this stuff worth it? Instead, Instead, I focus on the cross. I focus on the cross, on what it reveals about the goodness of God. The goodness of God in a world of gut-wrenching evil, of gut-wrenching nonsense. This doesn't fully answer Ivan's question. The children, what should I do about them? Nothing fully answers it. I don't think anything can. I don't think anything should. Because if it answers it, again, you're back to justified. I'm sorry. I don't want to justify these evils. Evil isn't explicable. Because if one could explain it, one sort of justifies it. And I'm sorry, with all the evil out there and all the things out there, the last thing I want to do is try to justify it. Though it doesn't fully answer the question, and I don't think anything ever will, I don't think anything ever should, it just helps me live with it unanswered, which for now is good enough. No, with the cross before me, it's more than enough, at least for now. And though one day we are promised we will know more than we are known, I'm not convinced there's ever going to be answers, good answers for what is ultimately unanswerable and should remain unanswerable.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. Free listening and sharing of this message, and over 8,000 other presentations by more than 100 speakers on 50 different topics, is now available at our American Christian Ministries mobile app for Android and Apple devices, and on our secure website, or call 800-233-4450 if you are in the USA or Canada. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help to prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.